So I've got to start with, you know, in the log, in the producer's notes, you guys talk about, you know, utilizing from the story the three chairs as the three characters. But I find it kind of interesting that there's three people who kind of came up with this idea. There's you, Adam, and then Laura. Is that correct?
Yeah, totally.
So that's kind of weird how it...
endless. All those threes, right? I mean, one of the sort of mystery hook lines of the film, on the inside of the film, is when Thoreau says, long ago I lost a hound, a horse, and a turtle dove. And I've been on their trail ever since. Everybody's fought about what that line means. Nobody knows. Emerson didn't understand what it meant. Scholars have written about it, argued about it forever. But it's just that wonderful three, you know. I mean, it's all those great trinities in the world. As soon as you triangulate something happens. So I think, you know, with you're perceptive. I think it's a great idea, what you're saying. You know, there is some kind of weird thing when you build something with two other people as opposed to one other. You know, usually the conversation is sort of one-on-one, but in our early day, and eventually it did become, I think, in the building of the script itself between Adam and I, but we did conceive of this thing very much, outline it and write the story as a threesome. So, I think it, you're right, it's conceived on this kind of Trinitarian idea, and we worked from that place. So I'm curious about it too. I mean, if I was really asked to dive into that and understand it a little more, maybe what I'd say is something along the lines of, you're always, best thing about threes is that it kind of is the best way to keep from getting too bored, you know? It's like with twos, when you're working in a dyad, the argument is sort of always clear what it is, right? One person thinks this, the other person thinks that. That happens a lot of times in the editing room, for instance. You know, the editor thinks one thing, the director thinks another. It's a very kind of dual sort of conversation. I think what's interesting maybe with threes is that what ends up happening is one person thinks one thing, another person that thinks another thing. The third person might think that's something else, but usually it somehow relates to one or both of verse two, and it kind of creates, I mean, you know, what Eisenstein said, 2 + 1 + 1 = 3, right? So a third person kind of creates this weird triangulation effect. And I think maybe that the way that the film flows, there's a very, have you seen the movie, by the way?
Oh, yeah, I loved it.
Oh, okay, great. The pacing of the movie, as you know, is very, very, very unique. It's kind of its own thing. It works in a very particular way. It operates over time in a particular way. It uses duration in a particular way. And I think I've never thought about it. I'm kind of sideswiped by the question, but I love the idea that part of the reason for this pacing is because it was off. A lot of what we were doing was built in threes. And, of course, there is, again, not to go back to Eisenstein and be super Professor Boopface about all this, but, I mean, a lot of the film is working with collage in a particular kind of way, montage in a particular kind of way, you know, and trying to elicit a third thing. I mean, that's certainly Thoreau was doing the same thing, right? Thoreau's talking about a couple of different concepts, but what he's really trying to do is produce an attitude, right? He's not actually telling us what to do. The third thing that he's trying to elicit is an attitude about, you know, experience and existence and the choices one makes. But it's kind of cool, like, it is conjuring. I guess what happens in threesomes is there's more conjuring that happens because of that diffusion of the third. Boy, man, I haven't even, like... I haven't even smoked any weed today, and I'm talking to you, so I don't know what's going on. But I love the idea. I totally want to jam on it with you. I love the thought.
Well, let's.
You know, I mean, a lot of. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, you go ahead.
Let's keep going with it, because the way I viewed the film, that what caught my eye was obviously the visual side of it, the way you guys shot it, the beauty of the scenery of the area and the Rocky Mountains, and also in town as well. But your musical background, Laura's musical background, the music behind the film really touched me, and then boom, animation with Alice's character kind of took me out of the film completely. It was like, whoa, where are they going? And then, I mean, there's three levels of the film. There's the animation, there's the music or the score, and then obviously the beauty of what you guys captured. Was that always in the thought process, was adding that animation as a third thing?
Oh, yeah. The animation was before the film. I wanted to work with Laura because she was the animator, composer. That was, I didn't even know I was going to do Walden at the time. I mean, honestly, if you really want to know about the genesis of the project, it came from animation. Laura works with stop motion, so she takes a single object, right, and she transforms it over the course of 2 or 3 minutes in a music video, right? So I didn't know it was going to be Thoreau. I knew it was going to be Laura, and I knew it was going to be the Rocky Mountain. That's what I knew. I knew I was going to work on a project like that. You know, this is 7 years we're talking about. Seven, 8 years. So at the very beginning, I knew those two things. And I loved Laura's means of transforming an object. And it reminded me of Whitman and Thoreau, the Whitman first. And then Thoreau second. I mean, it reminded me of the way in which one single sound, like a bell from a village nearby, rings, and that guy's head just transforms it over the course of 3 or 4 pages. This is Thoreau we're talking about. Maybe, you know, transfigures it into all of these different things. And that reminded me, the Laura kind of, I sort of found Laura's work to be transcendental in its form. And so that really got me onto the idea of, wait a second, is there something here? Wow, okay, so the Rocky Mountains is kind of a construction, that idea of the wilderness, that's not, we take that as a priori, but it isn't. That's something we've inherited, you know, from the Sierra Club, from Outside Magazine, from the National Parks, from REI, all the way back to Thoreau. I mean, really, it's those guys, you know, with some help from Wordsworth and the British Romantics, but, you know, they create this idea of the outside. We didn't have it before. People were outside to work. They would get sick there. It was these Romantics coming up in the mid-19th century who start telling us to go outside is healthy. So to me, the connection kind of seemed clear. I was like, wow, I've got Laura, I've got the Rockies, I've got the outside, I've got a story about edge states, people who live on the edge in between civilization and wilderness. Cities like Denver, Portland, Maine, you know, places where there's real towns next to authentic wilderness where people's, you know, their mindsets is, they're really stretched between these two extremes. That's what Thoreau was interested in. And, that's what we wanted to explore with this thing, you know. So, when it comes to animation, yeah, I loved all that. I honestly wasn't sure what I was going to do with the animation. It became pretty clear early on in the development process that Laura, you know, Laura and I spent a lot of time with her grandmother at her nursing home. We actually shot the film at the very nursing home that Laura's grandmother lived and died in. I got to realizing that Laura was connecting in a really deep way with the Alice part of the story. And that, it was about that time when Adam and I were really working on the script. We've already outlined it between the three of us. We already outlined the 24-hour cycle. I had done a tone reel. We'd actually gone to Denver in 2013 and brought some actors there and shot a tone reel to see if the tone could work, because I usually like to shoot before I write. Maybe it sounds crazy, but it's how I work. And so, at the end of that, then it was suddenly clear to me that that the stop motion was a way of working with dementia. You know, I wanted to tell, what we wanted to do with dementia here was we wanted to try to do it from the inside. So most of the time, if you're going to see a representation of dementia, in film or TV, right? You're going to tell it from almost always the experience of the people outside of the patient. The patient is kind of like the constant, and the variable is the family, right? Or the nurses or whoever. So what I wanted to try to do was, what would it mean to get inside of the experience of reality slipping away and transforming right out from underneath you? So I thought maybe this whole animation thing, because we had this crack animator on board, and because I was, you know, obviously attracted to that and magnetized towards that from the beginning, I suddenly realized this was our way of actually telling Alice's story from the inside. And that, you know, I'm a big fan of William Tentridge, who was a big influence on the project. And Tentridge, who does charcoal, does a lot of things, but he does charcoal animation where he actually allows the eraser marks to be perceived in the work as things, as the motion is going on, you know? Have you ever seen any William Tentridge stuff?
Yeah, yeah. There was a, he had an exhibit come through Dallas. It was, and keep going. I'm fascinated by the charcoal.
Well, anyway, so I, you know, making Alice an artist, making that sketch pad of hers, you know, endowing that with a real kind of moment to moment experience of her day, allowed us to really kind of create a subjectivity of dementia, which you just don't really get a lot, because that's, you know, most of the time we're trying to appeal to people who have caretaken the patients, you know. So anyway, that was kind of how the animation ended up embracing the film. But again, it was there from the beginning because I was always so excited about that idea of the transformation of an object over time, you know, which I felt was basically how the Rose brain, weird, addled Asperger's brain worked, you know. So, but it worked its way in very much as a subjective in for Alice. So
if in 2013 you guys are shooting a little bit with some actors, did you have any of the cast that was in the film back then, or did they come much later on? And what was the order? I mean, I think Lynn obviously would have been one of the first.
Right. So Lynn and I had worked together, knew each other very well in the theater world in New York. And so I wanted her to do this from the beginning. So I did bring her out to Denver the first time. You're right. The two boys, those two guys also were there in Denver the first time. One of those guys lives in Chicago, and the other guy lives in Denver and really doesn't do very much acting, the guy with the beard. He's a farmer and a musician, but he is an amazing actor, one of my favorite actors I've worked with. Doesn't do a lot. Did some in his youth, basically. I had those guys out, I had Lynn out, and then I had sort of a stand-in for Ramirez. I didn't know it was Demian at the time. He was on the list, but I didn't know it was going to be him. And then we didn't have any of the other material. The tone reel was just with the four characters. I can show you the tone reel. It's very funny. It's totally different. Like, you could tell it's like a, I don't know, an text for the thing. But but it's it was almost like three music videos that we strung together just to see what it felt like, you know? There's not a lot of dialogue in it or anything. I was really trying to, like I said, I was trying to explore the tone. I didn't want to be in a situation, man, where, like, I was trying to sell the film or sell the idea, trying to finance the film. I didn't want to be in a situation where anyone didn't know exactly what it was we were going for, you know? So what the tone reel did, obviously, was it was both a way for me to learn how the tone of the film could work, and it was also a way for me to eventually, educate others about what we were going to create here. So, but at the time, no, we didn't have, you know, like the other name actors like Chris Sullivan and TJ and all those folks. We didn't, none of those folks were involved. It was more just exploration of theme, really, and time, you know, because it's really is a, fundamentally, I think Thoreau and the movie are both obsessed with one thing, which is time, you know, and that was what I really needed to kind of examine how I was going to handle that before we wrote the script, and then we wrote for about 2 years or something like that. So that would have been 14 into 15. I actually had an amazing opportunity to make another movie during that time, which I went and did, and then came back and was like, you know, at that time, man, it was like end of 15, and everyone's like, you know, Thoreau turns 217. Are you going to shit or get off the pot with this thing? You know, and that was really it. I mean, I was like, you know, that's right. Like, if we're going to, let's just not do this if we can't get it done by the bicentennial. Because those come around, what, once every 200 years, I'm told? So I was definitely like, okay, I gotta do this. So 16, I got married right at the beginning of the year, and then we just were off the races and just raising money like hell in the spring. We set the stage over the previous years. Ever since 13, we'd had a big party with the governor and all sorts of kind of things to kind of like light the wick of the thing. But then I just sprung into action in 16, and we were in pre-production by June. We were in principal by August, and that ran into September. And then I was in edit, you know, from September to January, and then, you know, all the rest. I colored it in Budapest. I did the sound in New York, gigantic, and then we printed and finished it this summer. So it's been a long, you know, they're always a long haul, you know, it is. But
so, yeah, speaking of that tone reel and the three tones, did you always have it as, you know, solitude, friendship, and society, or did that come with when the casting finalized?
No, that was the first thing. So, like, the very first thing before we knew anything about the whole entire movie was Laura, Adam, and I, with, like, four bottles of wine. Like, well, the joke is it's actually two meetings. This always makes me laugh, because we met first and all sat down, and I was like, okay, guys, we're going to do Walden. Has anybody read it? And of course, we were all like, I remember some of it. And I was like, well, I remember that it's really trippy. That's why I want to do it. But I think we need to all read it. So we went away for a week and read the book. And then we came back the next week. And that's when we had the bottles of wine. And that's when we said, you know, and at the time, listen, man, that was 2009. I don't know if you read Walden anytime recently, but that first chapter is a 90-page chapter called Economy. It's not about trees at all. The whole entire chapter is about renting things, about the way in which people sort of borrowed their soul away by trusting in sort of faulty mortgage of various kinds. He uses that metaphor in all sorts of ways. So, dude, it was leaving. That's where we were. And we were like, holy cow, nobody even knows how prophetic this. I mean, people call this book prophetic, but they have no idea how prophetic it is right now. So we were at that time, we were like, this is a financial crisis story. We're going to really dive into this. But I knew, you know, I'm a structuralist. I always kind of just, you know, bristle when people say that somebody like a Carlos Regattas or Kiarostami, or whoever you want to call it, is a structuralist. It's bullshit. Everybody's working on a structure. All those films are intimately, intimately structured. It's just that sometimes it's not as apparent. Sometimes it's subtle, but it's still very strong. There's always a backbone. So for me, I needed that, and that's why you have somebody like Adam in your life. And so, you know, he came to that meeting with that one quote. He just came with the quote that said, I have three chairs in my cabin, one for solitude, two for friendship, three for society. When he laid that down on the table, I just said, okay, we're good. That's our movie. 24 hours, three chairs, let's do it. So we knew at the time we were going to do that. We knew that before anything else happened. And we found our characters by the end of that night, I think, actually. You know, we'd had some friends we grew up with who kind of reminded us of those two boys. And I knew we wanted to kind of do an Apollo Dionysus thing with those two. And then Laura had a book. She was on tour. She had been on tour at the time, on the Tour de Fat with the New Belgian Brewery, doing the music for that. And she, like, found a copy of the book with this beautiful marginalia in the, you know, in the edge of the book, and at the front it said Alice, and it was this handwriting that felt like it was from the 30s, you know, so we kind of found Alice that night looking at her book, and I had recently been to a bank where I heard, you know, one kiosk over from me, a guy being, you know, a translator there to help explain a mortgage, to help a mortgage lender explain to a client that they were being foreclosed on, a Latino client. So I kind of, I had that society. So, you know, we knew all that stuff happened right away. And I had done a lot of radical adaptation of work before. I don't like to call it radical, by the way, but that is, that's, sometimes I have to call it that for people to understand my own definition of adaptation, you know. But I had done a lot of that kind of work before, and, you know, you don't, what doesn't work is you don't want to spend very long not knowing who the characters are. So for us, on this one, I'd made that mistake in previous projects. On this one, I didn't want to do that again. So that's why I didn't even want to walk out of that second meeting without knowing our characters. And we did. We knew all four of them by the time, by the end of that night, by the fourth bottle. So, so yes, that was, you know, that was sort of final, that three-part story. And then, obviously it helps everything else after that, like you were saying from the beginning. You know, it all kind of comes back to that, and the balance, how you're balancing the three.
So I've got to ask, one particular scene that kind of amazed me, I didn't see it coming at all, was when Ramirez has the sink, and he's run through the city, and he ends up at the weirdest, wildest party. Where did that come from, and how much fun was it to shoot that sequence?
Well, as you probably guessed, I mean, that is Laura in that sequence, right? And those are musicians, local musicians that she's played with forever, and all the people in that party are people who have known about and been involved in the film for the last 7 years in one way or another. The house that party is at is the creation of a very celebrated kinetic sculpture artist in Colorado. His name is Les Sundy, and he's out of Fort Collins, and we had been working with him on the film since 13, with the idea that eventually the interior of that space would figure into our story. You know, I always call it the, actually, to speak of another adaptation, which in my mind is the correct definition of that word, would be something like an Apocalypse Now. Right, that's a proper adaptation. And people are confused. They confuse the words adaptation and translation a lot. But anyway, so I in Apocalypse Now, you might remember the Dolong Bridge. They finally get to the bridge, and all the lights are there, and the Playboy bunnies, and suddenly it's just surreal to this whole other level. They're not even supposed to be in a place like that. You know, I mean, that kind of departure is a kind of canonical step in a lot of the great stories that I've loved in my life. So to me, you know, at the end of the day, when you're stretched to, you know, when you're in what we're calling, you know, the edge state, when you're stretched to your edge like that, I don't know, the universe just kind of invites you into somewhere even more outlandish, even more unpredictable. But of course, the key to it is that Ramirez can no longer fight it anymore. And in putting that sink down, he's kind of laying his arms down. It was obviously so much fun to shoot because we were having a real party. It was kind of like, it wasn't the wrap party, but it was like the wrap party. I mean, we had a ton of people all knew the film at this gorgeous house that's a sculpture that this artist has been making for 35 years. Like it's a continual process that he did his whole life, just making this sculpture of his house. It was just, it was fucking amazing. I mean, it was so special to be able to take process, the process of the film and the product of the film, and sort of blend them and get them to the point where they kind of don't recognize each other, you know? And that's one of the things I love about that party scene. All those people are family members and musicians and prominent artists in the Colorado area. And, it's a big celebration of the state, that actual scene, in a sense. And it's an invitation, you know, as Ramirez kind of falls down the rabbit hole, it's an invitation to surrender. I'm glad you picked the scene up. I mean, it's one of my favorites, actually.
Well, I've got to ask, you know, you've brought up so many elements of Colorado. What's it mean that you guys are going to premiere this at the Denver Film Festival? I imagine another party will ensue. I mean, this has got to be a beautiful, not closure, but a beautiful way to kick off the next stage of where this film can go.
You know, man, that's exactly right. And I think that's the whole thing, you know, in one's mind, you know, our timing was a little off for a certain set of festivals just because of when we finished. But, and you know, you go for the top tier festivals, of course, because it's good for the health of the film, perhaps. But then you have to really start asking yourself, what is the health of the film, you know? And I think that, you know, Mitch and I, the lead producer, Mitch Dickman and I, we made a commitment when we were raising this money. And that was, and Shane Boris also, the three of us. And that was, we're going to do this film to table thing, you know? And we really wanted to use, we used that word, and we used it without irony. I mean, we really meant it, which was, you know, of Colorado, by Colorado artists, of Colorado themes, and for Colorado audiences. If we'd shot this movie and then gone off somewhere else to premiere it, I think it would just be, there would be a little bit of hypocrisy in that idea of film to table, which is what I think of as regional cuisine or regional cinema, you know. And let's be clear, the financing for this film is all, like, big-time Colorado arts philanthropists. This is not film financing. There's only some of the financing came from New York, most of it. I mean, like, as in, like, 80% of it. It's coming from the people who have built the Clifford Still Museum, the Museum of Contemporary Art, the Denver Art Museum, Colorado, you know? So, for them, this is important for them, too, that there is a kind of visible return on the promise of the film itself to Colorado, you know? And like you say, this is not the end, it's the beginning, technically, but in a certain sense, it helps, for me anyway, it was the truest way for us to launch the story. To be there with everybody who made it, to be there with this multiple layers of community who participated in this thing. All the way from investment, all the way through to all these different kinds of folks who gave their spaces and gave their huge, you know, 20,000 acre ranches and all these different things you can imagine that kind of went into making this thing happen. So to me, the Denver Film Festival is really the only place for us to premiere it. Now I'm, of course, hoping and looking forward to sending it all about, and we're looking very hard and trying to make a choice about where in Europe we'd like to see it, you know, open, and where else among the region and the coast we want to see it go. But given that this was, you know, that this was really a sort of a local, meant to be something of deep local themes, expressing in the space itself. I'm really just so happy that we can premiere there. And if you've been or are a filmmaker yourself, the other thing I would say that you'll recognize is, I mean, the premiere is going to be a lot bigger in Denver than it would have been somewhere else. You know, all the people who are there, the support of the governor and the film office, we had a great incentive deal on the project. It's just, we have so much more connection there. We're going to have the cabin that was used in the film will be on the red carpet. I mean, it's crazy shit that you could never do in any other scenario, you know? So in a certain sense, I think it's almost like the film itself continues past the end credits because we're able to create an event out of doing it in Denver. All the musicians who played in the movie, they're going to be playing at the after party, you know? So it's kind of like as much an experience as it is a film. So that's something I believe in. I come from many, many years of directing theater all over the world. And so to me, I'm really thrilled at the fact that because we're in Denver, we get to make an experience out of the whole thing. You know?
Well, I definitely hope it's a wonderful time. And I think it's poetic that our conversation has just reached the 30-minute mark. I think that 3 keeps popping up. It's kind of eerie. Alex, I really appreciate the time. I was blown away by the movie, and I'll keep in touch with Sarah to see how everything goes, but I hope we can keep in touch in the future for sure.
Absolutely, man. Don't ever